Alt NPR.
Love and Radio wants to know your secrets. Tell us online at loveandradio.org. Click on Leave Us an Audio Message Now.
Love and Radio.
Love and Radio.
Love and Radio.
There's a phrase in Japanese, meiwake o kakeru. So you put this disturbance upon others, right? I had a kid, I remember, cry because he had to sit next to me on the subway, and I just turned to him and I said, "Oh, it's all right, you know, I'm Japanese." And he kind of got, and I said it in Japanese, and he got really confused and a little bit more scared. And so I told him I was from Hokkaido, which was the northern island, like above Honshu, because there's four islands in Japan and then Okinawa. So there's four major islands. And I said, "You know, I'm just from Hokkaido. You've never been up there, but all the Japanese look like me up there." And he sort of cocked his head and looked at his mom and thought about it for about 2 seconds and started crying again. It didn't really work.
I'm standing inside of a bathroom. I'm not alone inside of the bathroom. In the bathroom with me are a gin and tonic, which is about 3/4 full, and a computer, which is recording my voice, and Nick van de Kalk, which is holding this really phallic microphone at me. He's sitting on the toilet, and I've never done this before, and I'm just going to have to be okay with it. It looks like the level's really low.
Yeah.
So the whole point of this trip to New Zealand was that I had just broken up with my girlfriend, and a friend of mine had just broken up with his girlfriend, and we decided that we were going to like drive around and isolate ourselves from society and hate women for a while. And we decided we were going to rent a car. That's what we were going to do. We were going to drive around. And I think that probably both saved us from really offending and boring a lot of people on these buses, and it also saved us from, it prevented us from enjoying ourselves, because what we did the whole time we were there was we like talked and talked and talked about these women who had been in our lives, and we kept on driving by these buses. So these buses are all over New Zealand, and we kept on passing them by, and we like got this economy car, and there were just like two dudes in this economy car, and we would pass by the buses, and I swear to God, it was like Lionel Richie was performing on every bus, and we would drive by, and like free drinks were being passed. I know this wasn't actually happening, but we would like look up, and there were just like all these hot women that was like, "Celebrate, good time, come," and like drinks were being passed back and forth, and like everybody was unclothed, and like that's what it felt like looking up half of a story into the windows of these buses, where clearly people were stopping every night and just like and just trading partners and looking at amazing New Zealand sunsets and drinking beer with each other and sleeping together, mostly just sleeping together. And instead what we did is we rented this car and we drove around and we talked about our ex-girlfriends. And we're generally angry with our ex-girlfriends, and then we would stop and we would camp for the night, and then we would wake up and we would get back in the little car. We'd talk about our ex-girlfriends for another 6 hours while we went to like the next place where we were going to wander around and like look at New Zealand before we would camp and then get back in our car and talk about our ex-girlfriends. And then we went on a 3-day hike, and it's supposed to be the national pride and joy of New Zealand. These 3 days. It's called the Milford Trek, and it usually kind of rains, but the idea is you see jungles and glaciers and glacier-carved streams and all sorts of gorgeous things, and it's the birthright of every New Zealander. So the first night we stopped, and it was a short hike, so everybody had to waste time, so I sat and I was reading a book in the little cabin that they give you where you're supposed to stop, and there's a rule in hiking that I learned that's just tacitly understood that you're not allowed to wear bright colors, because bright colors are not cool at all. You have to wear, like, somber, muted greens and maybe an understated grayish blue if you're feeling daring, but the whole point is that you were at one with the things that surround you, and you certainly don't want to stick out, and because that would be a little awkward. So I was sitting there in this cabin, and this shocking neon yellow appeared at the door, and then inside of this ring of shocking neon yellow was this little face. And then it disappeared, and then it appeared again, and then it opened the door, and this little Japanese woman walked through the door, and then after her walked a little Japanese woman in shocking neon blue, and then after her in shocking neon orange, and then shocking neon pink. So these four Japanese women walked in, dressed in a way that you're not supposed to, and they sat down next to me. Then one of them looked at me, and she passed me a juice box. And I didn't really know what to do. And it was pretty clear that we weren't going to share a language. And I looked at her, and I did the thing that you do when you don't share a language with someone, which is you nod furiously. So I nodded furiously. And she nodded furiously, and then I nodded furiously. And then I took her juice box. I wasn't sure whether I was supposed to, like, drink the juice box, or I didn't know what was going to happen. So then her guide showed up, who was this Japanese guy who spoke that kind of English where he says cool a lot. And he started translating, and he said, she's worried about you. I don't know why she was worried about me. And he says, you're hiking 3 days? And I said, yes. And he said, she's only hiking one day. And I didn't know how to respond to that. And then she sort of, like, pointed at the juice box again, and he said, she's worried that you might not have enough to eat. So she gave me a juice box. And then all of the rest of them were, like, shamed because they had their juice boxes, but they weren't giving it to the poor hiker who was going to go for 3 days, so, like, they all gave me their juice boxes. And then two of them gave me their yogurts. So I had, like, four juice boxes sitting in front of me and two yogurts, and I didn't really know what to do. So I just, like, nodded to everybody and said thanks, and then nodded again and then said thanks again. And then I, like, tried to read again because I don't know what to do when somebody gives you a lot of food that you can't really use. And then I felt like I had to give them something back because they'd given something to me. So I told them that my father had been stationed on Okinawa, and all they heard was Okinawa. So I went, blah, 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 Okinawa. And then they all nodded. They're like, Okinawa, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I nodded back, and I said Okinawa. And so we didn't really know what happened, but, like, they knew I'd been to Okinawa, and I hadn't. But it was okay, because we all knew what the word Okinawa meant. We knew that Okinawa was a place, and Okinawa, 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 Okinawa. So then, and then one of them... And this was the only time that any of them, like, acted alone. She looked at me, and she said something. I looked at her, and I did, the smile and the nod, because I was waiting. And then the tour guide, he said, she has a question for you. And I, like, looked really expectant. I, like, looked down at my juice boxes, and I looked really thankful. And then she said something again, and he said, when American men travel, do they travel with their wives? I didn't have a wife, and I was on the misogyny tour of New Zealand, so I didn't really have an answer to that, except that I imagine, which is what I told them, that if I did have a wife, that we would travel together, that I sort of imagined, although I don't really know that that's the idea of having a wife, is that, like, you know, you walk through the world together, and that's what you do, you sort of proceed, and the world passes by, and you talk to each other about what's going on in the world, and what's going on with your children, and that's kind of like how marriage works, and then there was silence. He translated that, and then nothing happened. And then I felt like that's not a thing that you would normally ask a person that you've just met. So I felt like I had to ask them something. So I asked when Japanese women travel, do they travel with their husbands? And he translated this, and they all giggled. And they all did that thing. They did that, like, geisha thing that you see in the movies where they, like, covered their hands with their mouths because they were so embarrassed of their giggling that they, like, had to hide their giggling from me. And then one of them said something, and he just translated, no. So that was the only answer I got. No. And now I didn't even feel like I had to be polite. I was, like, genuinely curious. So I said, why don't you take your husbands with you when you travel? And they somehow understood that. This didn't have to be translated. Like, it was pretty clear what I was asking. And one of them said something, and it just, like, shot out like machine gun fire. Like, and then they all just lost it. Like, they didn't even bother covering their mouths. They just, like, lost it, like, around the table. Just, like, general hilarity and four juice boxes and two yogurts. And I was confused. And the tour guide said, because we hate feeding them. And then there was such general relief that that had come out that all of them piled on. So after the one woman said, because we hate feeding them, and every time somebody said something, like, it was general, like, hilarity among the other four, and they would do this, like, not even embarrassed giggling, but, like, really, like, Japanese belly laughing, and which is just like American belly laughing. And then one of them said, I gave my husband to my daughter, which I guess means that the daughter was responsible for him. And then one of them said, I left my husband at a hotel. And then one of them said, I gave him a can opener, I told him good luck. And then that was it. And then after they shared that, and we laughed because when you talk to someone with whom you don't share a language, the slightest bit of comedy is such a relief that, like, you have to hang on it for 5 minutes. And it's like getting a joke in a foreign language for the first time. It's the funniest thing you've ever heard, because all that's going on inside of you is not the mechanics of the joke, but like, ah, I made a funny! They made the funny, and I heard the funny, and I know the funny. There's a certain luxury talking to a stranger that allows you to tell them something that if you told it within your own circle of friends, within your own sort of circle of shared experience, could have tremendous consequences. And that could be, I cheat on my taxes. That could be, I'm having an affair. That could be something. It's some secret that in your life carries great consequence, but to a stranger carries none at all. So you have the opportunity to unburden yourself to this person with no consequence whatsoever. But after that first consequence, you have to have earned the next one. So these four women, they had this confidence. They had given me something. They had felt like they felt sorry for the grueling 3-day hike that I was about to take. And they had given me their juice boxes and their yogurt. And they felt like they, in return, could share this thing. And the thing that was so important that they had to tell me, the one thing they had to convey in the world, was that it is the life's burden of a Japanese woman to take care of her husband. And they had to, like, they had to explain it in a particularly degrading way. So it wasn't just like that, like, oh, well, I gave him a bunch of freeze-dried meals, or, like, I put a bunch of stuff in the fridge and he's going to be okay. They had to, like, explain what they'd done to their husbands in these demeaning ways, like, I gave him to my daughter, now she's his problem. I gave him to strangers. And the husbands are evidently completely incapable of even of boiling water so they can feed themselves. And then there was just silence. And there was my book and the juice boxes and the yogurt and these four women in their really, really bright coats. And then the rain stopped and they all got up. And these, like, four really brightly dressed Japanese women disappeared back down the trail to go back to the trailhead, to go back to Japan to take care of their husbands. And that was what I was left with, is this confidence that they had to share with me, that the best thing that they could do is once every 3 years demean their husbands. And four juice boxes and 2 yogurts.
They have that old Beat Takashi TV show that they play, I guess on, is it Spike TV? Like, I don't have cable. One of the cable shows carries it, and it's like extreme something where people are doing this stupid games course, and I guess it's becoming really popular now. But it's like a really old show. It's like from the 70s or maybe the 80s. I don't know. Like, nobody watches that anymore, and doesn't accurately represent the landscape of Japanese TV. But the kinds of things we like to import are the ones that we can kind of, again, like I was talking about how they fit us into a certain image, you know, but we want the one that we can fit into that, oh, those crazy Japanese image. Like, this makes no sense. This is crazy. They're just ridiculous. you know, as if there's nothing meaningful going on there. But there is meaning-making, you know, in these ridiculous tasks.
When I was in college, I made friends with this woman named Kyoko, who was one of the many Japanese women at my school, which was a music school. And so we would end up cooking dinner together a lot, and I didn't have a ton of female friends at that point, so it was really nice to spend time with her. And it was really common for Japanese people, men and women, to give each other back rubs. Like, that was, I think for some reason, Japanese people have really tight back muscles. It was never like a pleasure thing. It was like, just like they would just give each other these really like aggressive, hard back massages. So, so I would always rub Kyoko's back and she'd rub mine. And while I was doing that, I would notice that she has this little like altar set up in the corner. It was kind of, I recognized it as a Buddhist altar, which was something that I was always interested in Buddhism. So I started to ask her about it, and it looked sort of like a traditional altar. It had a little Buddha picture, like a photograph of a statue of the Buddha, and it had these prayer beads, and it had incense, and sometimes I think it might have had fruit. But I asked her about it, and she said, "Oh yeah, I'm a Buddhist." And she's like, and I said, "Oh, that's really interesting. I've always been really interested in Buddhism." So she's like, "Oh yeah, you should come to temple with me. You come to temple." And we went to this house in Watertown, I think, and there were all these Japanese people there, and everybody was super friendly and super nice, and it was kind of a time in my life where I was maybe in need of being around really nice people, But there was one weird thing, which was that they kept talking about this Holy Family, and they had these affectionate nicknames for the family. And they would show, they showed a video of the family and of the daughters of the family. So it was like a husband and wife, and then a daughter, and then these two mysterious sons who they would allude to sometimes and like say in very reverential ways. Both of whom were deceased. So I didn't really know what to make of that, but I really respected Kyoko, and these people seemed really nice, so I just went along with it. And the sons, both of whom had died in somewhat like mysterious circumstances that you never really understood why or how they died or from what they died from. After the religion had founded, when they died, they'd been like contacted. Crying in the wilderness. They made this connection to the spiritual world, so that you would be, you could, through these sons, channel what your ancestors' karma was, so that you would sit with a spiritual medium who would sort of go into a trance and then contact the sons, who would figure out your ancestors' karma, like how your ancestors' spirit was being tortured in sort of a purgatory. And then by understanding that, you could do some sort of symbolic thing that would release your ancestors' karma, and then you would end up releasing your own karma, because in this theory of Buddhism, and I think in a lot of theories of Buddhism, your karma, your like the kind of weight of your soul, is passed down through generations. So by releasing your ancestors' karma, you release your own, and then you can transcend the world and become like enlightened like the Buddha. And I had a really hard time with that, and I would always ask them about that. And my friend Kyoko was a delightful person, and would always, you know, encourage me to stay. And I realized that she had, within the constrictions of this group, she had like this pressure that I was her spiritual child, and that was the word she used, and they used, that like that she was shepherding me into the group, but she bore a certain spiritual responsibility for having me there, and so like there was like she had a responsibility to keep me there. So I kept going, and I started taking occasional weekend trips with them, with this group from Boston, to their really large temple in New York. There was a lot of talk about the organization, the church, but a lot of people just goofing around, and really nice people, very interesting, a lot of them really successful, Japanese students or Japanese businessmen. And it was an interesting service. I mean, there was definitely a lot of discomforting parts about it, and all of them to do with this Holy Family idea, but it was a really beautiful space and very tastefully decorated. They would have taiko drumming, like the big Japanese drums. I remember one time the guy who was driving us down was this really wealthy young Japanese kid, probably 19 or 20, and he had a green Range Rover, I think. And this was like before SUVs were gigantic, so I mean, it was a big deal to have this car. He's obviously really like he was in college and a really wealthy kid. And very, it was very, very Japanese, like very kind of wound up and guilt. I mean, some stereotypes I have maybe about some Japanese people, but very guilt oriented and like really stressed out. And he, and we were running a little bit late. I think he was about 20 minutes late. And he was so guilt stricken by being late that he drove like solidly at about 90 miles an hour from Boston to New York, which was one of the most frightful car trips I ever had. So, and I was like thinking like, this is supposed to be my way of becoming enlightened and getting spiritual salvation, but in the meantime, I may die on the way to New York. And also, if he kills somebody, is that person going to become enlightened? And I guess in this sort of perfectionist, absolutist way of thinking, I was like, this is as much BS as any other religious thing that I've ever tried. I think maybe that might have been like the beginning of the end for me. I have a lot of uncomfortability with what's going on, and I keep telling myself it's not a cult, it's not a cult. But in the meantime, I feel like as I let myself get drawn into this, I'm losing my own spirit and my own ability to say, this doesn't feel right for me. I sit down with this lady, older Japanese lady, maybe in her 50s. She looks at me, and I'm sort of praying. I'm doing the prayer that they sort of prepared me for, which is freaking me out because I feel like by doing this prayer, I'm giving up my own free will, sort of. But I'm kneeling there, and she's in front of me, and I start to pray, and she's saying, pray harder, pray harder. I can't get the connection. And then, like, I think at some point, like, it finally clicks, and she, like, goes into this trance, and her eyes, like, no joke, start spinning around in her head. When I sat down with her, she just told me things about the spiritual family, about the leaders of the religion, and how they, you know, they really needed me to pray harder and be better at this before things could happen. But in the meantime, like, her eyes really are spinning around in her head, and she's totally freaking out, and I'm, like, kind of freaked by the whole thing, but also really, like, I'm kind of disappointed because I want some real, like, I want something that proves to me that the whole thing wasn't a total sham, and I'm not getting it. I'm, like, getting this, like, more of the same. And it made me wonder about my commitment to the whole situation because I said, I thought, you know, maybe this is true. Maybe, I mean, these are all intelligent people. Maybe this really is the right way, and maybe I'm, my doubt, which is heavy and is really holding me back. You need to pray harder. You need to pray harder. You need to pray harder.
Listening to Love and Radio. The show was produced by Nick Krandercock, who wears women's underwear. Adrienne Mathewitz is a contributing editor. On this episode, we heard from Abby Margolis, who is not pronounced Abby Margolis, Paul McAvoy, who is actually pronounced Paul McAvoy, and Brendan Greeley, who is pronouncing
exactly like I just read it because that is my name. For more information about the show, the one you just listened to, not mine, go to loveandradio.com. Or you can tell your own story on the show. Go to loveandradio.org and click on Leave an Audio Message Now using Odeo Technology, odeo.com. And check out Nick and Adrian's day jobs, Public Radio Exchange, where you can help them get their work on boring, old, regular public radio, PRX.org.
Alt.